Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Gnar Trees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson is a landmark work of gonzo journalism that follows a frantic road trip into the Nevada desert at the dawn of the 1970s. Presented through the frantic perspective of journalist Raul Duke and his attorney, Dr. S. Tom. Gonzo, the book begins as a reporting assignment tied to Las Vegas, but quickly becomes a chaotic descent into excess, paranoia, and dark comedy. Thompson blends first-hand observation with satire, exaggeration, and cultural critique, using the city of casinos and neon as a stage for examining the collapse of 1960s idealism. Beneath its outrageous scenes, the narrative probes deeper questions about power, consumer culture, media, and the shifting meaning of the American dream. The result is a fast, hallucinatory journey that reads like both a travelogue and a warning, capturing an era when freedom, profit, and disillusionment collided at full speed. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, gonzo journalism as method and message. The book is widely associated with gonzo journalism, a style in which the reporter becomes a central character and the boundary between observation and participation collapses. Rather than pretending to be neutral, the narrator foregrounds bias, panic, and impulse, turning subjectivity into the main reporting tool. This approach is not only a stylistic signature, but also a commentary on the limits of conventional journalism. By exaggerating and distorting events, the narrative raises a practical question. What does truth look like in a culture built on advertising, spectacle, and carefully managed images? Las Vegas, designed to overwhelm the senses and monetize fantasy, becomes an ideal testing ground. The narrator's erratic perceptions mimic the city's sensory overload, suggesting that objective distance may be impossible in environments engineered to manipulate attention. The book also shows how voice can function as analysis. The frantic tone, the sudden shifts in mood, and the impulsive digressions are not random quirks but part of the argument that the era itself is incoherent. In that sense, gonzo becomes both a reporting technique and a diagnosis of American media reality. Secondly, Las Vegas as a symbolic landscape of consumption. Las Vegas is more than a setting. It functions as a symbolic landscape where desire is packaged, sold, and endlessly renewed. The city's casinos, hotels, and themed environments create a controlled dream space, promising instant transformation while keeping visitors locked in cycles of spending and sensation. The book uses this backdrop to explore how consumer culture can replace meaning with spectacle. The characters move through spaces that resemble movie sets, where the performance of wealth and pleasure matters more than genuine experience. That artificiality sharpens the satire. If the American dream claims to reward effort and virtue, Las Vegas offers a shortcut fantasy in which luck and illusion dominate. The narrator's obsessive focus on surfaces, neon, uniforms, cocktails, and promotional language becomes a way to reveal the machinery of temptation. At the same time, the city exposes a darker underside, exhaustion, paranoia, and emptiness that follows constant stimulation. By staging the journey amid casinos and conference halls, the book implies that modern America often confuses entertainment with freedom. The result is a portrait of a culture that sells escape while quietly enforcing conformity through craving. Thirdly, the collapse of 60s idealism and the search for the dream. A major current running beneath the comedy and chaos is a mourning for the fading promise of the 1960s. The book repeatedly returns to the idea that a hopeful cultural wave rose and then crashed, leaving behind disorientation and cynicism. Rather than presenting a tidy political history, the narrative conveys this shift through mood, a sense of betrayal, exhaustion, and the inability to believe in grand narratives. The American dream becomes a contested idea, no longer a shared aspiration but a marketing slogan or a private hallucination. The protagonists chase assignments and thrills, yet their frantic movement feels like a substitute for direction. This restless momentum mirrors a broader cultural drift as the country transitions into a more hard-edged decade shaped by backlash, institutional power, and commercialization. Las Vegas becomes the perfect stage for this transition because it is a dream factory that never asks what the dream costs. Through its manic scenes, the book suggests that the era's utopian hopes did not simply disappear, they were absorbed and repackaged into consumer fantasies. The resulting emptiness fuels the narrative's desperation, turning the trip into a warped quest for a dream that may no longer exist. Fourthly, paranoia, authority, and the performance of control. The book is charged with paranoia, not just as an effect of intoxication, but as a response to the feeling of being watched and managed. Police, hotel security, institutions, and social norms appear as forces that maintain order while protecting the systems that profit from disorder. This tension is central to the satire. The city sells abandon, yet it enforces strict boundaries to keep the money flowing and the image intact. The protagonist's fear of consequences, their sudden impulses to flee, and their fixation on authority figures highlight how fragile freedom can be when it depends on permission. The narrative also portrays authority as theatrical. Uniforms, procedures, and official language are shown as costumes and scripts that create legitimacy. In that light, the protagonists are not the only performers. The entire environment is staged, from casino hospitality to professional conferences, each with its own rituals of control. This perspective turns paranoia into a kind of clarity, an instinct that the system is less random than it seems. The book does not offer a policy program, but it dramatizes a question that remains contemporary: when a culture markets liberation, who benefits and who pays the price for the illusion of choice? Lastly, dark comedy, unreliable perception, and moral unease. One reason the book endures is its ability to make readers laugh while also unsettling them. The comedy often comes from escalation. Small misjudgments become catastrophes, ordinary interactions become absurd confrontations, and the narrator's internal monologue turns everyday scenes into grotesque theater. Yet the humor is inseparable from moral unease. The protagonist's behavior is reckless, sometimes cruel, and frequently self-destructive. The book does not invite simple admiration. Instead, it uses the unreliable perception of the narrator to keep readers off balance, forcing them to question what is happening and what it signifies. This instability becomes a literary tool for exploring how people rationalize excess and avoid accountability. As the trip intensifies, the laughter can curdle into discomfort, which is part of the point. The book suggests that a society built on appetite will generate both comedians and casualties, and sometimes they are the same person. By mixing slapstick scenes with moments of dread, it captures the way escapism can slide into menace. The result is not a moral lecture, but a portrait of a culture where entertainment and harm can coexist in the same brightly lit room. In conclusion, this book suits readers who want more than a straightforward story. It is ideal for anyone interested in American cultural history, journalism, counterculture, and satire, as well as writers who want to study how voice can carry analysis. It can also appeal to readers drawn to dark comedy, road narratives, and books that examine national myths from the inside. The benefit lies in how it trains attention. By exaggerating the textures of consumer spectacle and the anxiety beneath it, the book helps readers recognize how environments shape perception, behavior, and desire. It encourages skepticism toward packaged dreams and invites reflection on what people chase when they say they want freedom. Compared to similar books about the 1960s and 1970s, it stands out for its fearless perspective and innovative form. Many accounts explain the era with hindsight, but this one immerses you in the confusion as it happens, using humor and dread to make cultural critique memorable. Its influence on narrative nonfiction and modern media commentary is hard to overstate. If you want a book that is entertaining, unsettling, and historically resonant in equal measure, it is worth buying and revisiting. If you would like to support Hunter S. Thompson, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.